Hello, and welcome to the Japan Distilled Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Lyman, and I'm recording in Aloha Whiskey Bar in Ikebukuro, Tokyo, with a very special guest. Today, I'm talking with Stefan Van Eyken, author of The Whiskey Rising and many other very interesting things. Stefan, welcome to Japan Distilled. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
As we know, Japanese whiskey over the last decade or so has really just kind of gone gangbusters. And you were in Japan when that trend began.
Yes, I was here before it began, actually. So I'm originally from Belgium, and my background's in music. I don't have any riveting stories of, an interest in Japanese culture, you know, whether it be anime or something like that. But, you know, I ended up in Japan through music, actually. So the idea was to study here for 1 year, to study contemporary Japanese music, which I did. But then that 1 year, which started in the fall of 2000, turned into 24 years and counting. So I'm still here. So when I arrived here in 2000, now in retrospect, those were the golden years, because at that time, very few people were interested in Japanese whiskey, hard as it may be to believe that, including, and I would say especially in Japan. So at the time when I arrived here, people who were, you know, even remotely interested in quality spirits had a very negative feeling about the domestic production, you know, about domestic whiskey. They thought, well, that's just, you know, the cheap stuff. You know, it's good if you're on a budget. It helps you get, you know, boozed up and so on. But the real good stuff, you know, is scotch or bourbon, you know, to a lesser extent. So that was the climate when I arrived here. So I moved from Scotland to Japan. And of course, while living in Scotland, I enjoyed visiting distilleries. It was an exhilarating time, you know, so many distilleries, so many good whiskey producers there. And so when I moved to Japan, I thought, well, that's all over now that I'm in Japan. And actually, for the first couple of years, I didn't really go to any specialist whiskey bars. I didn't really visit any distilleries. Now, again, you know, this may be difficult to believe, but at the time, there were only 7 active distilleries when I arrived here in 2000, right? And when I say active, I mean that most of these distilleries worked maybe 1 or 2 days a week, or maybe, you know, they worked for a couple of months throughout the year just to keep the equipment in working condition. There was no such thing as whiskey tourism, and if there was, it was very, very under the radar. So I actually discovered Japanese whiskey and Japanese whiskey making and Japanese distilleries in the margin of my other activities here in Japan. So you know, when I would be traveling to discover the cultural riches of the country, you know, and I would be in, say, Yamanashi Prefecture, I would discover, oh, well, actually, there's quite a large distillery nearby. So, why not check it out? Hakushu Distillery. Or when I would travel to Karuizawa, I actually went there for the museum, you know, the Merchant Museum of Art. And then I saw next door, there was this old dilapidated distillery, Karuizawa Distillery. So that's how actually I made my first distillery visits in Japan, you know, in the margin of other activities, you know, mostly, you know, sightseeing or tourism or whatever you want to call it. So I kind of discovered that side of Japan by accident, almost. And then, of course, visiting those distilleries, I would try some of the whiskey there. And then, you know, I would try and seek out more of the whiskey. And very quickly, I discovered that the quality was very high, and I didn't really understand why Japanese whiskey was getting the cold shoulder here in Japan from Japanese people, why they looked down on it. By that time, when I arrived here in 2000, Japanese whiskey consumption in Japan had been on a downward trend for 15 years, or like a sharp downward trend, and it would continue for 7-8 more years. So most of that whiskey that I was discovering by accident on these distillery visits was fairly long-aged whiskey, you know, 15, 20 years old, longer, 25 years old. And the quality was superb. And in those days, you could actually try those whiskeys. And then if you liked them enough, you could actually buy them very easily. I often come back to this story. You know, there's a very famous electronics chain of stores in Japan, Big Camera, where they have a little liquor section. They still do now. In those days, 15, 20 years ago, they had whole shelves full of Suntory so-called owner's casks, single cask bottlings that you could buy any day of the week for about 10,000 yen a bottle, give or take, depending on the age. And you had a choice of, say, you know, a port matured whiskey or a Mizunara matured whiskey, a sherry matured whiskey, a bourbon matured. You had your pick, you know, and these bottles were available. Also, Karuizawa Distillery, for example, if you went there, they were not in production. They actually stopped producing in 2000, but there were still people taking care of the distillery there and of the stock that was still there. So if you went to the Mercian Museum of Art and then you went next door to the little distillery shop where they sold a lot of the Mercian wines, but also some of the whiskies, you had a whole shelf of Karuizawa whiskies with bottles from every single vintage. The idea being that, you know, that some people would walk in there and be like, oh, this is my birth year. I'll buy a bottle of this. So it's hard to believe now that that was possible. So in retrospect, I should have, you know, rented a truck and bought everything then. I could have retired a long time ago. But at the time, we didn't know that that was about to change and about to change radically. So, yeah, but so at least I lived through those golden years, as I call them. So I can't complain too much, I guess.
That's a great perspective. And to think that it was only within the last 20, 30 years that was possible. And you have a similar story to Christopher, actually. He came to Japan for a year. And right. He's now been here for 22 plus. So
it happens a lot. Yeah.
Now, so when you began this exploration, obviously you already knew Scotch whiskey quite well from your time in Scotland. But when did you realize that there was an opportunity to begin, I guess, evangelizing or promoting these whiskeys? And that eventually obviously led to your book, which is an absolutely must own for any fan of whiskey generally.
Thank you. When I started visiting distilleries after I discovered Hakushu, after I discovered Karuizawa and so on, like I said, there weren't many active distilleries. There were, you know, just seven active distilleries at the time, not all of them open to the public. When I get into something I'd like to know more, I'd like to find out the history, the ethos, the philosophy behind it, and you know, all that nitty-gritty and so on. That's just the way my brain works. And so I wanted to find out more, but I quickly realized that it was very difficult. Like I said, you know, there was a very negative perception of Japanese whiskey here in Japan. So even in the Japanese language, there wasn't all that much. In other languages, say, you know, in English, there was hardly anything at all out there. And so, of course, I saw that and I thought, well, I'm sure there are other people who feel the same way as me, or who, once they do try some of these Japanese whiskies, would feel the same way and would want to know more about the history and how it's made and how it's drunk and so on. And so I thought, well, if no one's doing it, well, someone's got to be the first. As it happens, I actually wasn't the first. So there was a gentleman by the name of Chris Bunting who'd had, you know, a similar experience to mine. But he came from a journalism background. So for him, when he noticed that gap of knowledge of writing on this subject, for him, obviously, you know, immediately he felt, well, this is perfect, coming from a background of journalism to try and fill that gap. And so he started up Nojata. So I was visiting distilleries at the same time. And so after a while, because Chris was doing this on his own, right? There's only so much you can do as a person on your own. I noticed that some things were going unreported, and this is not said from a position of blame at all. Like, he was doing a lot of work as it was by himself. But I thought, well, I visit these distilleries and I would sometimes talk with people making whiskey there, or with, say, blenders or bartenders and so on. I would have the opportunity to visit some warehouses and so on. And I would, you know, have these great stories. And I felt, well, be a shame not to share those stories. So actually, initially, I set up my own blog to share those stories. But then very soon, Chris said, well, it's much better, you know, rather than having like two, I don't want to say competing blogs, but like two blogs running parallel, to have one that's very strong and where we can work together in terms of spreading knowledge and enthusiasm of Japanese whiskey. And actually, in those years, it wasn't just Chris and myself. There were, you know, a few other people who, from a similar position as ours, you know, contributed blog posts and articles. Chris and I were in an ideal position because we both lived here. So, of course, it's much easier to report from the ground. But yeah, so those were the early years of spreading knowledge about and enthusiasm about Japanese whiskey. Mm-hmm.
That's right. And for those of you listeners who are paying attention, Chris Bunting's name might sound familiar. He was my co-author on The Complete Guide to Japanese Drinks. It was a lot of his original research that I used for several of the chapters in that book. So it's funny, I had actually forgotten about Nonjata. It's been a while since it's been an active site, but that was a treasure trove of information at the time for those interested in Japanese whiskey.
Yeah, I hear that a lot from people who were who got into whiskey, you know, in say, you know, around 2008, 2009, 2010, around there. People, you know, often come up to me and say like, oh yeah, the Nonjata years, you know, I learned a lot about various things thanks to the posts that you guys put up at the time. What was also very rewarding at the time is that, so it wasn't just that we were talking about distilleries and history and stuff like that. We were putting a lot of reviews of Japanese whiskey on the site as well. Initially, it was basically to help people make informed choices about the sort of whiskey that they might enjoy. So we would give tasting notes and some information about the style of a certain whiskey and so on. And then, you know, if you felt like, oh, this sounds right up my alley, you could actually go out and buy these bottles, right? That was the intention. So the reviews that we put out, it was always possible, except for the last maybe year or 2 years, but I'll come back to that, to actually, after reading them, go out and purchase a bottle like that. People forget about that. Say, for example, the very famous The Game series of Shinanoya, which had 8 editions. But the first one was on the shelves for more than half a year. I know because I bought a bottle initially and then I slowly drank it. And then half a year later, when it was gone, I actually went back and I bought another one. So that was still doable in those days. And I'm not talking about the dark ages, right? This is 10 years ago. But of course, we, in a sense, we became a little bit of a victim of our own success, because the more enthusiasm we spread about Japanese whiskey, the more people got interested. And of course, it wasn't, you know, an easily replenishable resource. You know, those whiskeys, those single cask bottlings, say the Karuizawas or long-aged Yamazaki owners casks and so on, once they're gone, right? So there came a point towards 2015, I would say, where sometimes we would review a whiskey and then actually we weren't able to go and get a bottle ourselves anymore because they were gone too quickly. Basically, so in 2016, having been asked a couple of times before whether I would write a book about Japanese whiskey, I'd always declined because I have a full-time job in music education, I have a family and so on. So I felt, you know, if I'm going to write a book, I want to write a good book. That's just, I don't like to do things half-assed. So I'd refused it a number of times. But then there came a point at which I guess the need for such a book about Japanese whiskey was so great that they actually asked someone based in the UK, a whiskey writer, to write a book about Japanese whiskey. And that person, being a professional whiskey writer, he accepted, and he then went about writing that book without ever having set foot in Japan and using quite a lot of information, by his own admission, you know, I'm not saying anything bizarre here, from Nonjata, you know, all this information that we had put on the blog, not just myself, but Chris and some of the other people involved, for free. Right, we used our own pocket money to go out and buy bottles and review them and so on, to pay for the trips to the distilleries and so on. We never saw any money from Nonjata. So when that happened, I felt, well, okay, there clearly is this strong need for a book, because this may be very difficult to imagine. There wasn't a book in any language, including in Japanese, about Japanese whiskey. This is so difficult to believe, right? Like, this would be the equivalent of, say, a Japanese person writing the first ever book about Belgian beer. Like, it'd be hard to conceive of that, right? But that's the sort of position that I found myself in. And then, so then when Cider Mill Press came to me asking again whether I would write a book, I finally said, okay, I'll do it. And then I'll give it, you know, as accurate a picture of the state of the Japanese whiskey scene as I can. And then I decided that Nonjata had to go on hiatus. Chris had already left Nonjata because he was forced to move back to the UK in the wake of the big earthquake and tsunami for personal reasons. So he was no longer on the ground here. I kept doing the groundwork here in the years after. And because I felt, well, There are various people writing other books. I cannot keep putting all this information, this very up-to-date information from the ground for free on a blog and then risk that someone publishes, finishes their manuscript before me and publishes it. And obviously the perception is such, you know, the printed word having an inherent sort of prestige attached to it, the perception would be that the first person who puts that out in print is the original, whereas what comes after is derivative or, you know, so I didn't want to be in that position. So that's why Nonjata was put on hiatus, and it never came out of that. But it was partially also because it was getting much more difficult to buy bottles, and the prices of bottles started going up and so on. So we were no longer in a position where I could just go out and buy a bottle and spend quite a lot of money and then open it and review it for the benefit of our readers. So it was getting harder. And actually something that led me to the Ghost series now is in 2013. So we would sometimes announce releases that were forthcoming, right? So we would get some information from retailers or from importers and so on when they were about to release a special limited edition or a single cask bottling or something like that. And so this happened with my good friends at Whiskey/Number One Drinks at the time. And they had a bottle coming out, and it was towards the end of the year. It was the Christmas period, and it was a Karuizawa single cask. And I believe it was bottled for Isetan or something like that. And they shared a sample with me, and they said, oh yeah, feel free to put it on the blog. You know, this will be coming out. I guess we'd reached that critical point. You don't see it, you know, it's a very gradual process. But now looking back, that was sort of the critical moment, the tipping point. We posted the review, and that bottle sold out once it came out in the shop instantly, which kind of took them by surprise because they didn't want it to sell out instantly. They wanted it to be on the shelves for a while. It was Christmas, you know, to have something available there that people could pick up as a nice Christmas present or something like that. So they were sort of taken aback by this reaction and by the idea that, well, like a little blog post can result in like this bottle selling out like, you know, overnight almost. And it was then that I was invited by one of the directors of Number One Drinks and said, well, clearly your readers are thirsty for good quality whiskey. Why don't you do like a bottling just for the readers? And of course, he didn't have to ask me twice, also because it was a Karuizawa. So there were about 50 Karuizawa casks that I could pick from. And I still remember it's one of the most pleasant afternoons I've spent since moving to Japan, tasting my way through those casks. And there were actually two cask samples that I liked out of the 50. I was very difficult. And one of them was a little bit pungent. And the outturn of that was much higher, was around 400 or 450 bottles. I don't remember exactly. And then there was another, the other sample that I liked was a very un-Karuizawa-like Karuizawa-like, very, rather than bold and oily and big flavors, it was very gentle and elegant and, you know, elegantly fruity, kind of strawberry notes and so on. But the outturn of that was 140 bottles. And so we're talking 2013, right? So 10 years ago, basically. And I was so scared that we wouldn't be able to sell all 450 bottles of that other cask sample that I decided to go for the elegant un-Karuizawa-like Karuizawa, because I felt, well, 140 bottles, the risk is minimal. And if it ends up being the case that I have to buy, you know, 50, 60, that's something I can do. But like buying 200, 300 bottles is something I couldn't do. So again, I mentioned this like to illustrate how times have changed. But so that was the beginning of the Ghost series. So it was just this request to do a bottling for the readers of Nonjata. And then, of course, I started thinking about labels because at the time, of course, the card series was ongoing at the time. And that was a fantastic concept. There was the game series, which I also liked a lot, you know, very, very strong concept there. I spent a lot of sleepless nights thinking, what can I do for the label, right? Because this is something special. You've got to come up with something special, right? And so ultimately, you know, I like, you know, ukiyo-e, you know, woodblock prints, hanga. And there's a series called New Forms of 36 Ghosts, which are illustrations of traditional ghost stories, you know, stories featuring supernatural elements, and so on, illustrated by one of the great last masters of classic woodblock printing, Yoshitoshi. And this resonance, spirits, you know, spirits and so on, and then, you know, of course, whiskey being a spirit, I thought, well, this is something that could work. And so I started by picking a particularly striking woodblock print for that first bottling. Obviously, I was having so much fun doing this first bottling that deep down, I wanted to do more, right? It wasn't going to be a series. It was just going to be a one-off. But I knew, you know, I had this desire, this wish to keep doing that because it's a lot of fun. So I thought, well, I broke my head over this. I had so many sleepless nights thinking what to do for a label. I don't want to be in that position again. So at least by going for a series where there are 36 prints, I knew that I'd be good for at least 36 bottles. And so now, you know, it's 2024. We're about to release number 22, number 23, and number 24. So, but I've always taken a very relaxed approach to doing these bottlings. I haven't pursued them aggressively because I'm not dependent on these bottlings, you know, to make a living. You know, this is something I do out of pure joy. I let, you know, the element of serendipity play a big role in these bottlings. So I'm just receptive. And then once in a while, you know, someone will say, hey, there's this chance of going out there and maybe tasting something and maybe doing something. And then I'll, you know, explore that chance. And that's how actually all of the bottlings up until number 21 have happened. You know, I don't pursue them aggressively. I just allow them to sort of happen organically. Obviously, you have to have a minimal sort of agency. Otherwise, nothing happens in this world. But you know, I just want to be receptive to coincidence, to serendipity and so on. So I think maybe it'll be another, maybe, you know, 7-8 years, who knows, maybe 10 years before we reach number 36, but that's fine. It's also, interestingly, and obviously that was not my intention at the time, I couldn't know that the Japanese whiskey scene would change so much. It's also a mirror of how the Japanese whiskey scene has changed, because if you look at the first ghost bottlings that I did, the number one, Karuizawa, number two, another Karuizawa, number three, a Hanyu, all closed distilleries, number four, a 33-year-old grain whiskey from Kawasaki Distillery, again, a ghost distillery, you know, closed distillery, and so on. So you have these now legendary closed distilleries, high ages on the bottle. But then, of course, as we move closer to the present day, the ages start dropping and, you know, we see bottlings that are 3 years old, 4 years old. Those are the times we live in. It's absolutely inconceivable now to bottle, you know, something with a double-digit age statement. I think it'll be another 5-10 years before that's possible. And that's also kind of a reason why I want to go slow with the rest of the goes, because I hope that, you know, it's still doable to do a few bottlings once we start to sort of reap the fruit of the of this renaissance, really, of Japanese whiskey, right? So now we're at a point where, you know, Ichiro's has whiskey in his warehouse that's 15, 16 years old. He hasn't released any as such, but, you know, but it's there. And Komagatake Distillery and some of the other distilleries have stuff that is, you know, starting to approach 10 years or maybe, you know, a little bit more. So I sort of look forward to seeing what those distilleries from the new wave, from the post 25-year period of consumption and production decline will be like when they're, say, you know, 14, 15, 16 years old. So, yeah.
I've only gotten my hands on one ghost bottle, but definitely want to get on that mailing list if I can. I think it sounds like something worth collecting. Shifting gears to your book, Whiskey Rising, when that hit the shelves, it changed how people thought about Japanese whiskey, I think, in a big way, because it's so detailed. You've got so much information in there about each distillery, about the people making the whiskey, about the brands, the iconic bottlings.
Yes. Well, actually, I said for a long time that I wouldn't do a second edition. The first edition, so I wrote in, as I said, in 2016, and it took me half a year. Of course, I don't mean every waking minute of that half year, because I still had my full-time job. I still had my family life going on at the same time. But really, other than work and family obligations, I had no time for anything else during those 6 months. It was all traveling to once again visit those distilleries, to get the latest, you know, state of each distillery, bars, researching the history and so on, and then all the writing, obviously. So it was quite exhausting, and I very often have that sort of thing. Like I climbed Ben Nevis in my younger years, and I said after that I'm never doing that again, and I still haven't. And I thought it was going to be something like that, right? But like when I do something that's really arduous, I put like all my energy, everything I've got into that. That's just the way I work. And so I was happy when it was all over. So the first edition, there were 14 active distilleries, and they're all in there. You know, a bit of the history, the production processes and so on, the sort of whiskey expressions that they release and et cetera, et cetera. Then after that, of course, we saw distilleries popping up in Japan left and right. And I would still go and visit distilleries because I do a lot of writing for Whiskey Magazine UK and also for Whiskey Magazine France, which are under the same umbrella, but they're run by a different editorial team. So they have their own sort of articles. So I was still visiting distilleries that were popping up after the book came out and so on. Quickly, it became clear that the number of distilleries was going in the direction where for one person to visit all those distilleries in a short period of time, that it was becoming impossible. And so I didn't think it would be doable to do an update. And actually, I said, well, I think Whiskey Rising, the first edition of Whiskey Rising, paints a picture of the state of Japanese whiskey in 2016. And you know, it can stand like that. And if I do something else in the future, I just want to do another book, maybe, you know, about the newer distilleries, make it a different book rather than doing an update. But then, of course, the 100th anniversary of Japanese whiskey making came closer. You know, that was last year, 2023. And my publisher was very keen to get an update. So they'd asked me a couple of times in the previous years, and I'd always politely declined, and I really didn't have the time. But then it reached a point where they were like, well, if you can't do it, maybe we'll have to ask someone else to do the update to your book. And, you know, that book feels like my baby, right? So that that was just something that to me is inconceivable, right? Like people are welcome to write their own books, but, you know, Whiskey Rising, that felt like my baby. So I said, well, okay, maybe it's time to get to work and do the update. And so I finally said yes. And then again, I had to spend months and months and months visiting distilleries. So for the second edition, I was determined to include all the active distilleries by my deadline, which was August 2022, the end of August in 2022. And that was 41 active distilleries. In retrospect, I'm lucky because now we're not even halfway through 2024, but we're already at more than 110 active whiskey distilleries. So when I say now, I'm not doing an update to Whiskey Rising, I really mean it, because I'm in no situation to actually take a sabbatical from my work and my family to allow me to visit 110 distilleries in every sort of nook and cranny of Japan, some of them very remote. So in retrospect, maybe it was a good time to do that update for the 100th anniversary of Japanese whiskey. And it was difficult at the time because, of course, it was in the middle of the pandemic. So for some of the distilleries, I actually had to, you know, resort to the sort of tools that we got used to during the pandemic, like Zoom and teleconferencing and things like that. But I still, you know, did as much as I could in terms of visiting the actual distilleries. But yeah, at the moment, I think it's an impossible task, at least if you want to go into detail, which for me, that's always the most fascinating thing. Sometimes people tell me like, oh yeah, I've read your history part, the first part of Whiskey Rising and so on. Then with the distillery projects, yeah, you can only read so much about like, you know, washbacks and mash tuns and line arm orientations and things like that. But for me, you know, it's because whiskey, it's just a simple thing made from just a few ingredients using, you know, very similar processes between all the distilleries. So for me, it's precisely like those details and how those details vary from one distillery to another that make it interesting, right? Because they sort of offer a glimpse in what might explain the character of a certain whiskey, right? For me, like whiskey, it's a hermetic mystery. We will never be able to understand what makes a whiskey, you know, what it is, what what led to those flavors and aromas. We will never understand that. And that's part of the beauty of it, I think. But of course, you know, it's the human impulse is to try and understand, even knowing, you know, we won't be able to understand that the ultimate mystery of it, but to try and understand as much and to find these pointers why the liquid moved in a certain direction and why certain aromas might have emerged and so on. So this is something that intrigues me. So that's why I love visiting distilleries and spending a lot of time with people actually making the whiskey and learning about the, you know, the peculiarities of the production process at all these distilleries. Whereas my family, for sure, I would be like, well, if you've seen one distillery, you've seen them all. And I would strongly disagree, of course.
Yeah, we know that that's not true.
Yes.
So you mentioned that your original edition, the first edition, was the moment in time. It was 2016, State of Japanese Whiskey. Mm-hmm. And now you've done the State of Japanese Whiskey 2022. Mm-hmm. Here we are in very early 2024. You have now visited, you're one of the most accomplished whiskey writers in Japan, and you've now visited fewer than half of the active distilleries in the country. It's amazing to think about that there were only 14 when you started this project less than a decade ago, and now it's over 110 active, and there are over 200 whiskey licenses that have been issued. So there's the potential for another potential even doubling of what's currently active. It's massive growth. How is that sustainable?
That's a very good question. So actually, in the new edition of Whiskey Rising, I plotted the number of active distilleries in the course of Japanese whiskey history. Because, of course, people are very quick to say, like, oh, it's a bubble and so on. I wanted to, you know, to see how this had evolved over time, right? The highest point in history was in the early 80s when there were about around 35 active distilleries, whiskey distilleries in Japan. And then after that, there was a decline where whiskey distilleries stopped producing, were mothballed, were demolished and so on. And when we went down to 7 around 2006. And so then you have Ichiro, of course, in 2007 setting up Chichibu. And then you have a couple of others coming after that. You know, you have Mars restarting, you have Shizuoka, you have Akeshi and so on. A couple of distilleries being inspired by that example of Ichiro. And then quickly it goes to 14 and then it jumps to 30 and so on. And the increase, the exponential increase, it's unprecedented. There have never been this many distilleries in Japan. So I think maybe by the end of the year, there'll be more active whiskey distilleries in Japan than there are in Scotland, you know, a country with a much, much longer history of whiskey making. There are concerns, of course. So many of these new distilleries, they're set up by people who already produce some type of liquor, mostly sake producers or shochu producers. Without naming any distilleries, I visited some of the brand new distilleries, like distilleries where they just started literally, say, a few weeks before I went out there. And some of them were sake breweries who'd set up a whiskey distillery. I was a little bit concerned that, in a way, making whiskey is easy compared with making sake. Or this would be the general feeling, I'm sure, that making whiskey compared with making sake is way easier. I would agree with that. But, you know, making a decent whiskey is easy. Making a good and a very good whiskey is very difficult. And I would say equally difficult as it is to making a good sake, a good nihonshu, a good shochu, a good wine, and so on. But I think maybe some of these newer producers, they feel that because it's relatively easy to reach an acceptable result, that they are encouraged by this and feel, oh, well, you know, compared with like the know-how and the sort of tradition and the expertise you need to make a nihonshu, to make a sake, oh, whiskey, well, you know, we've been doing this for 4 weeks now and taste the new make, you know, it's great, right? Yeah, it's okay. So I'm a little bit concerned by this sort of attitude that I see where this feeling that making whiskey is an easy thing. And then, of course, now, all these distilleries think that they can be the next Ichiro, but 4, 5, 10 years down the line, there'll be winners and losers for sure, right? When there are only 7 active distilleries, there's enough room for everyone on the shelves of bars, in people's home bar, and so on. But when there are 110 distilleries, bars, retailers, drinks enthusiasts, or the casual drinker, you know, people have to make choices, and those choices will be made based on a number of factors, not only quality, although I would hope quality, you know, would be the determining factor in who ends up being the winners and who ends up being the losers. But I think price will also play an important factor in that, because we're now at a point where anyone can release a three-year-old whiskey for, say, 15,000 yen for a bottle, a price point which in Scotland, like, no one would release something at that price point, a three-year-old whiskey. People would laugh. But here, that's you know, just business as usual. But that, I think, won't last, because in the beginning, when there were these new distilleries popping up post-Ichiro, drinks enthusiasts wanted to be supportive and were keen to follow these stories from the beginning and were, you know, happy to buy a bottle of three-year-old whiskey, a bottle of four-year-old whiskey, and to follow the development of that whiskey distillery. And then they, you know, they would start to feel a sort of emotional attachment to a particular distillery that they liked and so on. But like I said, you know, when there's only two, three, four, five new distilleries, you can do that and find which one, you know, is up your alley. But when there are 110, that's almost like a full-time job, right? Like trying to figure out, you know, what distillery makes the sort of thing that you like or would like. So there's going to be problems to solve, I think, down the line. I don't want to sound like a wet towel, you know. So it's a renaissance, and it's a development, you know, the likes of which no one has seen in Japan. I like to be supportive and I like to be enthusiastic and I wish all of them the best, but just economics and common sense tell us that there will be winners and losers. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt about that. And you're right. Now there's so many distilleries. It's like, where do you begin when you're trying to explore the new? And for me, it's easy because I live in Kyushu. I want to support the local Kyushu suppliers or distilleries. And where I have hope on that side of things is if you're a distillery with a long history of working with grain-based shochu, rice or barley, and you've done barrel aging, you have a barrel aging program in place for your shochu products, I have a lot more confidence that you're going to be able to transition to a malt-based spirit and be successful. I'm less confident when it comes to something like a sake maker or a beer maker who doesn't have a history of the barrel aging process. That's such a vital component.
Absolutely,
to how a whiskey expresses. But certainly reason for hope for the industry, and also some cause for concern. Some people may lose their shirts.
Absolutely.
But hopefully not too many. Been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Really always enjoy talking with you, and hope to have you on again when time allows. But any closing thoughts you have about what you've got going on?
I visit as many distilleries as I can throughout the year for articles that I write for mostly Whiskey Magazine UK and Whiskey Magazine France. Now, those being magazines that people have to buy, not free information, they don't always reach a wide public. You know, obviously it's just the people who have subscriptions to these magazines who will read them, or the people who buy the magazines. I try as much as possible to show what's going on. So in a way, for me, I see those articles as being complements to Whiskey Rising, right? I can't do a new edition of Whiskey Rising every year or every other year. But those articles give people a sort of good idea of what's happening here on the ground. And so I visited a couple of very interesting new whiskey distilleries in Kagoshima, seeing, as you mentioned, Kyushu. And, you know, visiting some of these distilleries, like the best whiskey distilleries where people use the know-how that they have, in this case, from shochu making, and some ideas and some concepts that whiskey makers wouldn't think of themselves, and then combined with, you know, expertise in barrel aging, as you say, will result in some whiskies that are genuinely novel and that, you know, really have something to add to the ongoing story of Japanese whiskey. So those are the sort of distilleries that I'm very excited about. So I don't do a lot of social media. I don't blog anymore and so on. But I would say, yeah, if you have a chance, some of those articles on Whiskey Magazine UK, they become online a few months after they're published in the print magazine. So yeah, if you see Whiskey Magazine UK or Whiskey Magazine France, try and see if there's something about a new distillery in Japan.
Great. Well, again, thank you so much for being on the show. An absolute pleasure. And thank you all for listening to this episode of Japan Distilled with Stefan van Eyken of Whiskey Rising and Whiskey Magazine UK and France. Please check japandistilled.com for show notes from this episode and every episode. There's lots of really interesting information in there. Also, if you want to reach out on social media, you can find me on Instagram or Twitter. I refuse to call it X, at Japan Distilled. And if you haven't already, please consider rating and reviewing this podcast wherever you enjoy listening. And with that, kanpai.
Kanpai.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Distilled podcast. This has been Christopher Pellegrini with my co-host Stephen Lyman. Our theme song is Begin Anywhere by the very talented Tomoko Miyata. Audio engineering by the incomparable Rich Pav, who also edits the fantastic Uncanny Japan podcast with Teresa Matsuura. Please give that a listen as well if you're interested in Japanese fables and ghost stories.